Ah, but she was the queer old skewsha anyhow, and living at Trinket Toes. And sure, he was the queer old one.
Stand here, fucking bamboo, sir. Tell it, sir. I got pockets and I want to send
you. Wollte der Bach sei ein Fluss, der Fluss sei ein Strom.
Oči da ne vidijo.
Po čim je danes umetnost, ekonomika kulture in umetnosti?
V tokratni oddaji Oči da ne vidijo smo se odpravili zbistrit pogled na dvodnevni simpozi z naslovom Ekonomika likovnih umetnosti, ki je potekal na Ljubljanski ekonomski fakulteti. Na njem so predavatelji iz Evrope sfero likovne umetnosti umestili v aktualne vrednosti umetniških del in gibanja cen na umetniškem trgu. Cena, investicija, nagrada, tržišče in rentabilnost so pojmi, ki iz ust nekaterih ekonomistov enako dobro funkcionirajo na avtomobilskem trgu, trgu z nepremičninami ali, zakaj pa ne, celo v šolstvu, zdravstvu ali kulturi.
Sfera umetnosti in kulture si ponavadi predstavljamo kot brezinteresno, avtonomno družbeno sfero, ki največkrat ustreza opisom, kot so občutek za lepo, brezčasno, resnično ali nepokvarjeno. Tovrsten odnos do umetnosti je nastal skozi zgodovino, pogojenje z različnimi družbenimi spremembami, nastalimi v različnih časovnih obdobjih. Kdaj naj bi torej umetnost postala avtonomna?
Preden prisluhnemo ekonomistom, si privoščimo še pogled v zgodovino. Odgovor na to vprašanje najdemo v prispevku Maje Breznik z naslovom Spreminjanje pogojev v samostojnih poklicih v znanosti in umetnosti, ki je bil objavljen pred dvema letoma v edinstvenem zborniku Zveze svobodnih sindikatov Slovenije, sindikalno gibanje odpira nove poglede.
Umetnost kot avtonomna družbena sfera je bila, kot zapiše avtorica, zapisana v pravni red s francosko revolucijo. Položaj avtorja kot nosilca intelektualne lastnine, moralnih in sorodnih pravic, kodificiranih s pravnim redom, se je torej izoblikoval kot nasledek družbenega priznanja umetniškega poklica kot posebnega poklica. Francoska revolucija opravi z institucijo cehov, ki so dotlej vključevali ustvarjalce in umetnikom podeli nov družbeni status. Od takrat status ustvarjalca oziroma umetnika prežemajo različne družbene predstave, ki nekdanje odnose starega reda nadomestijo s prevladujočimi meščanskimi predstavami o geniju, bojemu ali odtujencu od družbenih norm.
Na simpoziju so predavatelji o umetnosti spregovorili kot o posebni sferi, ki predstavlja ekonomsko rentabilnost za mesta, turizem, prebivalce in državo. Umetniki in umetnice, poleg dodane simbolne vrednosti, proizvajajo dobiček, izgubo ali pa njihova dela v času finančne krize predstavljajo celo varno naložbo. V kriznih časih, ko je denar poceni, se najbolj splača svoj denar vložiti v preverjena dela impresionistov. Če je komu to najbolj jasno, je to ekonomistom, še posebno ekonomistom kulture, ki so razvili lastno disciplino. Kulturna ekonomika ima najdaljšo tradicijo v ZDA, Avstraliji, na Japonskem in Nizozemskem, veliko mlajši pa je njen razvoj v vzhodni Evropi, kjer je imela sfera umetnosti v socialističnih in komunističnih družbah specifično družbeno-politično vlogo.
O zgodovinskem razvoju kulturne ekonomike in privlačnosti kulturnega sektorja za gospodarstvo smo se pozanimali pri doktorju Arju Klamarju, profesorju ekonomije umetnosti in kulture na Erasmus Univerzi iz Rotterdama.
Well, cultural economics sort of dates, we think, from around 1968, when two economists, the most famous William Baumol, wrote an article, a book actually, first an article then a book about the economics of the performing arts. And one conclusion that they drew is, and that was an interesting insight, is that it's hard to gain productivity, to increase productivity in the arts field, so you would expect that arts would become more and more expensive compared to other sectors. That was one conclusion, and that sort of is the first insight, but some people go back further. But anyway, that's when the field of cultural economics sort of started. Then an association was set up in the 70s, I think, late 70s, and now we have sort of an international community of cultural economists. We are strongly represented in Europe, less so in the United States, and there's also a very strong association in Japan, strangely enough. Japan has a very active cultural economics program. At first, we were sort of marginal because we were only sort of interested in the arts per se, museums, performing arts, orchestras, and so on. But in the last 10 years, there has been much more interest in cultural economics because also policymakers have figured out that culture is an important engine of growth. You need a strong cultural sector. Why? Not just because it's fun, but it's also because it draws tourists. People like to live there. New companies want to come for that reason. And so it's sort of an attractor of all kinds of activities. And so policymakers realize that they need to pay attention to the cultural sector. Arts specifically, but creative industries more general. And so that's where we are now, that we try to figure out, as a cultural economist, what the effects are. And an important issue is also the financing, because here in Slovenia, but also in the rest of Europe, governments are heavily involved in subsidizing the arts. And the question is whether that is sustainable. And if the governments withdraw, which is happening right now in Holland, for example, but all over the place, then what are the alternatives? Now, that could be sponsors or people paying more for the arts, but it could also be in what we call the third sector, that is by way of donations. And then, now I don't know exactly what the experience here in Slovenia, but if you look at churches, have always been able to finance the cathedrals and the churches by people donating. And that has been true for the arts too. Although in Europe you see quite a few courts, royal courts, who paid for the arts. But in the Netherlands, for example, but certainly also in the United Kingdom, it were the bourgeoisie, the richer burghers, as we say, who set up museums, started orchestras, sort of supported artists. And we sort of think that that may have a comeback, that more of that practice will start. So that makes cultural economics a fascinating field. Because it seems that we sort of really are in the center of a great deal of activity right now, and interest in sort of these new economies. And so I think that we try to do the thinking that eventually also will be copied by mainstream economists. You still, if you do business economics, then you run into the notion of culture, because that is the culture of organizations. But if you look at sort of general economics, the study of markets and the study of economies, then there is virtually no mentioning of culture, as if culture doesn't matter, as if it doesn't matter that you operate in Slovenia versus Holland or the United States or China. And we are convinced that it does matter in terms of values and attitudes and so on, and practices. And that we economists have to pay attention. One reason why the euro, for example, has difficulties, the common currency, is because of cultural differences. And the Greeks operate very differently from the Germans. And that's what we will wrestle with. And so we economists have to pay attention, I would argue. But it is still a sort of marginal field. We still have difficulties in communication with mainstream economists who still have hard time recognizing the importance of this. We still have the economics field has a categorization of all fields, and we have the very last categorization, Z. And so it's sort of an afterthought, but I think that will change. I think in the next 10 years or so you will see a real turnaround, and that also mainstream economists will start getting interested in the cultural component of economies.
Kultura je torej lahko dobičkonosna. Tega sta se v kritiki kulturne produkcije svojega časa zavedala že Walter Benjamin in Theodor Adorno. Umetnine je možno tehnično reproducirati in čeprav morda izgubijo auro, je ključni Benjaminov poudarek v stavku, v katerem zapiše, da je auro umetniškega dela mogoče ustvariti naknadno, torej v produkciji, prodaji ali še kako drugače. Umetnine potem takem ljudje ne cenejo samo po njihovi materialni ali prodajni vrednosti, temveč tudi po simbolni in dodani vrednosti. Kaj o tem lahko pove kulturna ekonomika, za katero tržišče umetnine ni tabu, temveč vsakdanja praksa?
Profesor Arjo Klammer je na predavanju kot eden izmed redkih pomen vpliva ekonomije na kulturo in umetnost predstavil v širšem družbenem kontekstu. Iz perspektive kulturne ekonomike je koncept vrednosti širši od prevladujočega vzorca razmišljanja v ekonomiji. Tam gledajo na stvari po večini stališča prodaje in cene, medtem ko je Klammer poudaril, da je zanj kulturna dobrina metafora za conversation, razgovor med predstavniki različnih svetov v življenju umetniškega dela. Kot kulturni ekonom proučuje daljše obdobje umetnine, zanimanje se zanj ne konča s kupoprodajo. Tu so še posredniki, galerije, obiskovalci in trenutek transakcije zgolj eden izmed momentov, ki določajo naš odnos do kulture in umetnosti.
Klammerjeva metafora razgovora vključuje dve logiki delovanja, logiko tržišča in logiko vladanja, povezani v celotno socialno sfero in sfero domačega ognjišča, poimenovano oikos. Država, ki bedi nad logiko vladanja s svojimi zakoni in birokratskimi strukturami, v socialni sferi deluje kot protivtež logiki tržišča. Kot je omenil, smo ljudje bolj kot individuumi, predvsem socialna bitja. Zato je njegova kritika letela tudi na ekonomiste, ki celotno zanimanje usmerijo zgolj na logiko tržišča in pri tem zanemarjajo značilnosti celotne družbene sfere.
So to conclude, my suggestion is, if we want to make sense of a rather peculiar world as the art world, and to understand also its significance in the world at large, my argument would be that we economists do good to not focus just on the logic of the market, or the logic of governments, to broaden our perspective. And for that purpose, I would suggest, as also Hüther and Strasby do in their book, Bruno Frey is very much going in this direction too, is that we need some another vocabulary. And vocabulary there also needs when we are sort of confronted with questions from skeptics in the public who wonder why what the arts are good for. I think that we need to sort of arm ourselves with this broader perspective, because if we just stick to these logics, we will at one point be lost, I'm afraid.
Gostujoča predavanja so se osredotočala na različne študije primerov. Profesor Viktor Ginzburg iz Belgije je denimo v precej alkimistični maniri s pomočjo ekonometrije oceneval vpliv nagrad in vpliv prestiža v umetnosti. Predavanje se je osredotočalo na korelacije med nagrajevanimi izdelki in njihovimi uspehi s primeri iz sveta hollywoodskega filma, flamskega in italijanskega kanona v slikarstvu ter belgijskega Queen Elizabeth festivala v igranju klavirja. In predavateljevi zaključki. bolj splošno sprejete resnice, ki prehajajo iz votlega v prazno.
So what are the differences between the things which I looked at? Prize movies are also often box office successes. So you have the same with for movies as what you have for these musicians. Movies which get the Oscar are more successful than other movies. So the box office is usually larger. This is not so with books. Between 1980 and 1989, for example, no Pulitzer, which is the big American prize for novels, no Pulitzer winning or nominated title made it to the list of the 15 bestsellers in the United States. So whereas for movies, well, it's probably because movies is more of a popular art than novels. Prize movies are successful, prized books are not successful, and books that are not prized are successful. Movies and books are not necessarily produced with a competition in mind, and the artist is of course not present during the evaluation stage. In musical competitions, as well as in some sports such as figure skating, diving, horse dressage, the work is unwinding, judged in several stages, and in the presence of the artist who is producing it, which means that the art may reflect other qualities than talent, good-looking person, not good-looking person, and so forth, the order of appearance, etc. Similarities. Awards, prizes, and critics have an impact on success, at least for movies and for music. However, award winners, in the case of movies, award winners are often not the best ones 10 to 50 years later. Books, I didn't discuss books, but I have some results on books which is a much more difficult topic because you don't know exactly how to rate a book 20 or 30 years after it was published. But for books, there is no significant difference between prize-winning and shortlisted authors. So for books, the same happens as for the Oscars. There are 5 nominated movies, and one of them gets the Oscar. For books, it's the same. There are 5 nominated, say, Booker Prizes, and one gets the prize, and I will discuss what should be done in 2 minutes. So there is no significant difference between prize-winning and shortlisted authors, nominated authors. And perhaps more importantly, none of the big authors like Tolstoy, Kafka, Proust, Joyce, Zweig, Calvino, and Borges, for example, got the Nobel. Sienkiewicz got the Nobel for Quo Vadis. I don't know whether you... It's nice. It's a nice book, but still, I mean, it's not a great book. And the stupid Claude Simon, a French writer who is not known at all except in France, and I'm sure that nobody ever read him because it's very difficult to read. But he got the Nobel. Music interpreters are not ranked according to talent. So what, on the basis of what I have looked at, what can I suggest? The first is, why is it... I'm not so much against competitions. I'm a little against, but not fully. I accept competitions, but you can ask why it is necessary to provide a winner in each competition. And it's necessary, as I said in the beginning, people like blood, they need winners and losers.
Profesor Viktor Fernandez Blanco z Univerze v Ovideu iz Španije je predstavil ekonomijo muzejskih institucij in spregovoril o njihovi vlogi v tržni ekonomiji. Kot enega izmed vidikov je profesor Blanco omenjal ceno brezplačnega vstopa v muzej.
The first question when you face against the problem of price in the museums is the question if museums must be for free. There are some arguments in favor of this policy, but there are some drawbacks linked to any one of these arguments. The first argument is the redistributive effect. What's the redistributive effect? The idea is that if the museum is for free, that policy encourages the presence of lower class visitors. But the empirical evidence is suggesting us that people who visit are predominantly coming from higher class part of the society. So free entry is a policy who benefits wealthy people, who is really benefiting wealthy people. The second argument is that if the museum is for free, we can increase the number of visitors. But I'm not sure it's really true, because it depends how prices matter, no? How important are prices. And the empirical investigations, empirical evidence is that demand for museums is price inelastic, so price is not very relevant, a very relevant variable. No? Another argument, a more technical or more economic argument, the efficiency argument. The Pareto optimal pricing rule is to fix price equal to marginal cost. Since, as we saw later, the marginal cost is zero, the price must be zero. Yeah, but there are some points that might be present. No? First, if price is zero, the museum cannot cover full cost. So how can it survive? Again, we need public money, we need donations, private donations, we need other sources of finance if museums are for free. In case of congestion, the marginal cost is not zero, it's positive, so the price must be positive. And this is putting on us against the probability of ruling a discrimination price policy. A price for the exhibitions, the blockbuster exhibitions, which could congest the museum, and another price for normal visits. And this is a policy that is very common, at least in Spain, in our museums. And at the end, the marginal cost in the long run is not zero. So the efficient argument has its own drawbacks to be established. More arguments. A crowding out effect. If you are charging for admissions, you could reduce public grants or private donations, or even other sources of income coming from the cafe, the shop, and other ancillary items. It's not clear that fees reduce this income coming from other ancillary items, although it's more clear that it can reduce public grants. Externalities. Museums generate well-known positive externalities, which benefits for the entire population. In this case, the theory of market failure is telling us that public budgets are an efficient instrument for financing those organizations that generate positive externalities. But we need to remark that visitors are people who really benefit more. And if we apply the principle of benefit, these people, visitors, must pay some money for the visit. No?
Predstavljenih argumentov zoper brezplačni vstop v muzeje ne bo težko posvojiti tržno naravnanim muzejem, kot so muzeji Madame Tussaud in podobni. Tragičnost našega časa pa zaznamuje dejstvo, da morajo tudi muzeji, ki delujejo v javnem interesu, danes dokazovati svojo uspešnost na trgu. V skladu z ekonometričnim stališčem je profesor Blanco s primerjavo z mestnimi parkirišči prišel do zaključka, da je obiskovalec predvsem potrošnik in muzejske institucije predvsem tržni subjekti na trgu. Ali bi torej morali imeti muzeji brezplačen vstop?
If you think that the museum is giving you a service, I'm going to be very, very aggressive in some sense. No? If you think that the museum is giving you some service, you can pay for the service. But there are other things that in the city that are giving you services. For instance, parking. If you park in a parking, you have to pay, and you have to pay independent of time you use the parking. If you go to a museum to achieve another service, you have to pay for your service and you have to pay for the time you spend inside the museum. So it's a strong economic point of view. It's a museum like a parking. It's an enterprise that gives you a service.
Edini predavatelj na simpoziju, ki se ni ukvarjal zgolj s tržno vrednostjo umetnin, je bil profesor in vizualni umetnik Hans Abing iz Univerze v Amsterdamu. S predavanjem z naslovom Zakaj so umetniki revni je spregovoril o materialnem položaju umetnikov in umetnic ter razgrnil nekaj splošnih resnic o njihovem socialnem statusu.
So I'm an economist.
But I'm pretentious, and I'm going to say I'm writing a sociological study of art, artist, and so that's your destination also going to be. Hey? You start off as economist, but in the end you all will end up as sociologist, maybe. Okay, the main starting point is a contradiction. It's the we say the value of art is high, that is the symbolic value, but also the financial value. We heard about that. Some paintings are sold for millions, more than millions. We built huge, in Abu Dhabi, you just heard about it yesterday, they spent more than $1,000 million dollar on a new museum of modern art. You know these places, you have this opera building here in Ljubljana, which must have cost a lot to restoration. So there's lots of money for art, strangely enough. Yeah, we're always complaining that there's little money. No, there's lots of money, but the incomes of artists are low. So this seems to be a contradiction, and I would say no, it's not a contradiction. It is because the value of art is high, because there's so much money for art, that artists earn very little. So if we want to raise the incomes of artists, the answer is very simple. We should be less happy with art. okay. Now I'm quite serious about this. This is what the book is about. It sounds funny. And actually my expectation is that the symbolic value of art will go down in the next decades, and that therefore the incomes of artists will be more like that of other professionals. It's wishful thinking, but there are already some signs which go in that direction. I see them. But yes, it is quite uncertain. And of course, the high symbolic value of art is, there are so many people who have an interest in it, even artists, as we will say in a minute, that it may go on for quite a while. But it's not of all times. Eh? Art was did not always have this high symbolic value. People like Handel were servants. They were sitting with the servants at the table. So there have been a lot of development in the valuation of art, the symbolic valuation of art.
Ker se Bogomir Kovač kot eden izmed najavljenih predavateljev žal ni uspel udeležiti simpozija, je profesorica Vesna Čopič z Fakultete za družbene vede edina predstavila položaj kulture v Sloveniji. Kot v večini tako imenovanih tranzicijskih družb gre po njenem mnenju za zamrznjeno situacijo, saj tudi družbo v Sloveniji zaznamuje zamrznjena situacija glede sistematičnih raziskav na področju kulture. Ta je izgubila svojo družbeno-politično vlogo in kulturni sektor je danes odvisen predvsem od realnosti parapolitičnega sistema in posamičnih investicij, ki so podrejene zunanjim učinkom, predvsem tistim iz Evropske unije.
V zadnjih 20 letih naj bi se po besedah Čopičeve ohranjal status quo. Za javna sredstva se morajo javne institucije boriti skupaj z ostalimi. Vprašanje, kdo posreduje kulturne storitve, ni več pomembno, temveč postane pomembno vprašanje, kaj ponuja. To po njenih besedah ohranja videz demokratičnosti, a je v svojem bistvu netransparentno.
Zato je Vesna Čopič v svojem predavanju poudarila potrebo po fleksibilizaciji delovnih razmerij, saj naj bi dan danes v javnem sektorju v Sloveniji prevladovali močni sindikalni podporni mehanizmi, delavci in delavke v kulturi pa so večinoma še vedno zaposleni v javnih zavodih z redno obliko zaposlitve. Če je očitek, da imamo v Sloveniji rigiden birokratski in javni sistem upravičen, ne moremo brez pomislekov sprejeti tudi fleksibilizacije delovnih pogojev. Na očitek, da zagovarja pogoje tržne ekonomije, je Čopičeva poudarila, da se zavzema zgolj za deregulacijo in bolj pretočne oblike zaposlovanja.
Ne mara si tako imenovani model flexicurity, Kombinacijo fleksibilnosti in varnosti lahko privošči trg delovne sile v Skandinaviji. A je slovenski trg specifičen že zato, ker na področju umetnin ta ne obstaja. Če so bile v socializmu prepovedane dražbe umetnin, je prejšnji sistem zato poznal samo prispevke za gradnjo kulturnih ustanov in omejeno število svobodnjakov z večino umetnikov in umetnic, ki so spadali pod družbeno-politično poklicno kategorijo. Danes poznamo donacijo dela dohodnine kot podporni mehanizem za neprofitne in kulturne organizacije, ki pa po besedah navzočih v praksi ni popolnoma zaživela.
Najbolj neoliberalni ekonomisti v kulturni sferi vidijo poslednje neosvobojeno območje delovanja prostega trga. Tej neoliberalni ekonomiji se je zavezala tudi Slovenija kot podpisnica sporazuma s Svetovno trgovinsko organizacijo, WTO, ki državam članicam nalaga širitev proste menjave in logiko profita na dejavnosti kulture in izobraževanja. Torej polji, za kateri naj bi veljala pravica prostega dostopa in ne asocialna profitna logika tržne ekonomije.
Prevladujoče stališče zbranih ekonomistov, med njimi nekaj tistih, ki so pred profitom zagovarjali javni interes, ni presenetil. Prav tako ne preseneča njihovo skoraj slepo prepričanje, da je kapitalizem naravni habitus sleherne družbe, tudi tiste postsocialistične, ki je relativno pozno začela tržiti kulturo in umetnost ter pri tem izgubila zgodovinski spomin. Koristnost septembrskega simpozija se je izkazala v spoznanju, da kulture in umetnosti ne gre prepuščati zgolj ekonomistom, ki v njej vidijo zlato jamo. Zaradi logike profita ni v nevarnosti samo kultura, temveč celotna družba.
Oddajo smo pripravili tehnik Martin, Špikarja, Polona in Coma ter seveda avtor Dare Pejič.
But she was a queer old skelch anyhow, and Olivia Trinkentoes. I'm sure he was a queer old one.
Stand here, you fucking bamboo stool, Kellekuse. I've got problems and
I'm Wollte der Bach sei ein Fluss, der Fluss sei ein Strom.
Oči da ne vidijo.